Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Enyart, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. We are going to continue now a conversation from last week with Chris Peltz with the Holly Street Church of Christ in Denver, who hosts a radio show an hour before mine in Colorado on AM 670 KLTT. Chris, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, I appreciate it very much.
We were talking about what the Bible teaches about wine. And we do have two different opinions, two different doctrines. And so one or the other is correct, and God is the ultimate arbiter. But boy, do I appreciate the conversation.
Again, you know, the opportunity has been wonderful, and look forward to continuing the conversation.
I ended the last show talking about Jesus serving fermented wine at the Last Supper. And I believe overwhelmingly when the Bible speaks of wine, the context shows us it's fermented, it's regular wine. And I mentioned the times of the harvest and all that. Your thoughts?
Yeah, well, when it comes to the Lord's Supper, there's a couple of things that we know going all the way back to Exodus chapter 12, and that was that everything that was fermenting, every leavening agent was to be put out of the house. That would be one of the first things that I would point out. But when it comes to the Passover feast and that which was being drunk by Jesus, first of all, the word wine is never used right. In reference to the Lord's Supper. It is the blood of the grape, the fruit of the vine, that is used in reference to the Lord's Supper. There's no indication that would really draw any conclusion from the scriptures that this has to be anything that is alcoholic. In fact, I would think about Matthew chapter 9, for example, in verse 17, and I know this is a passage you probably have in your notes for discussion as well, but talking about putting new wine into new wineskins, that both would be preserved. There are some historical references to the preservation of grape juice, whether it is you bury it in a fish pond, whether, you know, different storing methods, and even diluting is something that we know Israel did. Isaiah chapter 1 talks about that. There was some condemnation in certain aspects when Jews would travel to Jerusalem, and perhaps the travel was so great that they would come and they would buy certain things when they were in Jerusalem. And so we know not only from Isaiah, Malachi, other passages, that some of those in the temple, Jesus ran out the money changers, but their scales were wicked. Sometimes they would dilute very strongly with water the juices that would be sold. And so there was condemnation, but we know they did it.
There are things that could be done. You could dilute wine so that nobody could possibly get drunk. You can store grape juice in virtual refrigeration. I remember going to Israel, going to Greece, and going to a Roman bath where they got the caldarium, the tepidarium, the frigidarium. And in parts of the world, you can have ice houses. You know, in Israel, I think the highest point is the Golan Heights, which is 7,200 feet. They weren't wealthy enough to transport snow and ice so that it was marketed. They sold snow cones in parts of the Roman Empire. But in Palestine and Israel, these things that you could do that were extremes that are not recorded in the Bible, that were not done routinely by the Jews, I don't see that they can override those unique things that could be done. Don't override all the overwhelming number of scriptures that talk about wine. When wine is mentioned, it's wine. It ferments. Like Jesus said, as you just quoted, you don't put new wine into old wineskins. The new wine must be put into new wineskins. I mean, it's idiomatic for Jesus to take the fermentation of wine, right? When the sugars in the wine break down from the yeast and they produce alcohol and they put off carbon dioxide, that's why the wineskins begin to burst. They blow up with gas and they'll burst. It was so idiomatic that Jesus used it as a figure for a spiritual lesson. So when Jesus served the wine, and you're right, it doesn't say wine. I've studied Greek for a few years at Bible college and at a Greek theology school here in Denver, an independent one. If I recall, gennomatos tes ampelu, it's just the fruit of the vine. And as with hundreds of references in the Bible, wine is wine, and that's why overwhelmingly it's used in the context of possibly getting drunk.
Well, it is used in the context. Wine is also used in the context of getting drunk, as well as being a blessing from its very existence before the grapes are even picked. Mm-hmm. And so it is a blessing. There's no doubt about that. And it is a curse in several passages as well. But when we come to the New Testament, again, we're talking about fruit of the vine. Again, wine is never used when it comes to the Lord's Supper. And with the wineskins, there's a couple of things that are necessary for that process to take place, because even new wineskins would burst if it was really fermenting and beginning to turn into wine. But notice, well, Jesus says they're both preserved.
Well, new wineskins are less likely to burst because they have more strength. And the reason there's a consideration that they'll burst is because of the fermentation. Chris, when you say that wine is not referenced at the Last Supper, that's a conclusion you're making. The fruit of the vine, they were drinking liquid that came from the grapevine. And those grapes were harvested at least a year earlier. And that grape juice begins fermenting immediately, especially in the Middle East. When we were in Greece, we do a Bible tour of a different country every few years. And our tour guide, Kostas Tsevas, he had a tour group just before ours, and he said they wanted to have communion with grape juice. And he said, I explained to them there is no such thing as grape juice. And they wouldn't believe him, so they said, bring us to a grocery store. And they went, and there was no grape juice. I mean, it didn't exist. They went to two stores. There was none. They had communion eventually with orange juice. And he said that in the Middle East, you harvest the grapes and you squeeze them, and they almost immediately begin to ferment. There's no such thing. Yes, the word wine could be used as a figure of speech for the wine off of the vine. Right, it's a figure of speech. But wine is wine, and it's so strained to say that the fruit of the vine, in fact, in Corinthians, Paul says they're getting drunk when they're having communion. He wouldn't say that if they're drinking grape juice. He just wouldn't use that term. People drank wine, and when they drank too much, they got drunk.
Well, in 1 Corinthians 11, the passage you referenced, they're talking about drinking much, or they had drunk much,
right,
is literally what it's talking about. And notice the contrast between those who eat and those who drink much, and then those who have nothing. And he tells them, listen,
yeah,
as you pointed
sure,
out,
there
so,
is a contrast.
So there wasn't a literal a drunkenness that was taking place.
Well, the Corinthians were such sinners. I mean, Paul lambasted them for their immorality and their tolerance of sin.
But so, what does he say about their drunkenness in chapter 6 in verse 11? Such were some of you. So he can't say in chapter 6 of 1 Corinthians, verses 9 through 11, that they were drunkards, and then come over in chapter 11 and say that they still are.
Well, the Corinthians, it's not one person. It's a whole community of people who, some of them were sexually immoral. Some of them were drunks. Think of a common sin, and the Corinthians struggled with it. It seems to me that you have to strain at a gnat with literally 200 passages to maintain that very difficult reading.
Well, first of all, you know, you have to take all the passages into consideration.
Right.
And I know you would agree with that, but and maybe this is to your point, and this would be a point we would agree on. You can't just look at one verse and say, there it is. You
right.
look at the Bible is established in patterns. Noah had a pattern. He was to follow that. Moses had a pattern. Hebrews chapter 7, you know, he was to
sure,
follow that pattern.
Sure, right.
We have a pattern. Paul told
right.
Timothy to follow the pattern.
And if our pattern is Christ, and if Jesus did drink wine, then a church that doesn't allow the drinking of wine, Jesus would not be qualified to be an elder at that church. He might not be allowed to attend that church. So there's a lot at stake here.
Well, and maybe that's where we should look at. Did Jesus drink alcohol? Did
sure.
he drink alcohol?
He not only drank it, but he also made wine. Of course, you know the passage in John chapter 2. And you know it very well. Jesus made wine. He turned water into wine. This was his first miracle, symbolizing that he would turn the shadow of the old covenant into the blood of the new covenant. He's substantively going to provide the sacrifice for us. That's why he turned water into wine. But the master of the feast said about the wine that Jesus made that this is really good wine. He said, every man at the beginning of a wedding sets out the good wine, and then when the guests have well drunk, then the inferior, you have kept the good wine until now.
Right. You seem to make an assumption that the good is in reference to what many people think today when it comes to vintage wine, when it comes to that which is aged and that which is better and perhaps more intoxicating. But that's not what this passage is talking about. First of all, notice who we're talking about. We're talking about Jesus in his first miracle that's recorded. Here we have the creator. We have the one who created the vine that takes from the water of the earth and puts into its own grapes pure, unadulterated juice. Here is the creator, the vine, according to John 15, who took water and put into those tubs pure juice. He put in that which was good and sweet. Because notice also, it says there that they had already well drunk, which is kind of a reference even that I made from 1 Corinthians 11. Here they had already well drunk. So if they had well drunk here, were they intoxicated already? And so Jesus contributing to what will end up now being drunkenness because they've already well drunk, Jesus providing that which, according to not only the Psalms, but Isaiah and other passages talks about the judgment that will be impaired. The Proverb writer 23 talking about they will see strange things, their mind will think perverse things. Is Jesus giving them that which, according to Leviticus 10 with the priesthood, is going to not allow them to discern what is holy and unholy, clean and unclean? I think it's a stretch to say that Jesus is making for them that which is going to allow them, and is condemned to do Habakkuk chapter 2 and Lamentations chapter 4. Right. And so I think it's clear that which is good is the purest, the cleanest, and later as that runs out, they would begin as custom to bring out that which would be more intoxicating or had set longer.
Considering your responses, I think you just made a second best point as I assess them in our previous show. You pointed out where the Bible warns against much wickedness. Taking that verse at face value, that was a proof text for your position. Here, I think your best argument is that if they're already well drunk and Jesus is making more alcoholic wine, then is he encouraging them to get even more drunk? I think that's a very reasonable question. When they said that every man at the beginning sets out the good wine, there was a standard for good wine. For example, if they boiled it, people today around the world, nobody boils wine to get rid of the alcohol. One reason is it's not going to taste good. And so their standard was, does this taste good? And Jesus made the kind of wine that the master of the feast would say, this tastes really good. Like the kind of wine that's put out at the beginning of the feast, it is so unreasonable to maintain that these hundreds of places in the Bible, they're all speaking of grape juice. They're not. When the Israelites got together, they enjoyed wine, and that wine was fermented grape juice. And so Jesus made the kind of wine that people would drink and get drunk, but God has filled the world with resources. Jesus could have given them a rack of lamb, and that rack of lamb, they could gorge themselves, put their finger down their throat, throw up, and eat again. Yes, God gives us the resources that some people use to hang themselves. But that is not God's guilt. If we misuse the blessings he gives us, that's our guilt.
Well, it is, absolutely. But the question would be, what is that true blessing? And very quickly, as far as what is good, remember even Joseph and the cupbearer, what was taking place? It was that they would squeeze the grapes into his cup. That's the very best. That was what would be good and the best of all. If certain things aren't available, but you're making an assumption of what is available and what is not available in this particular passage. But the word oinos, comes from from the history of the word itself comes from a man who had that name who was known for squeezing grapes. And so even the word itself, the history of the word, you know, comes from that which was the freshest and the purest. And even to make wine.
Chris, let me interrupt. Factually, I don't agree with that. You and I disagree on interpretation. Factually, I don't agree with that. But let's continue. I think that's the first factual thing that I've disagreed with in everything you've said. But go ahead.
All right.
I'm sorry I interrupted.
No, that's fine. And I'm not above going back and looking up and researching some more. But nevertheless, you know, when we come to the way wine is used, the word wine in the scripture and way it is what it's translated from, it is used in, as we said, a blessing and a curse. And that blessing was that purest. It was the blessing of the harvest. It was that which was a blessing to God and to man. And when it's used in its intoxicating form, it is used to in condemnation. It is used to stay away from with just very few exceptions. For example, Proverbs 31, give it to those who are dying. Strong drink is used in reference to that in Proverbs 31. So medicinal purposes, and you pointed out, you know, pouring wine on a wound, the alcohol, you know, for a wound or something of that nature.
You know, a little wine for your stomach's sake.
In 1 Timothy 5.
And the alcohol, going back to the time of Hammurabi, a couple thousand years before Christ, they treated wounds with beer. The ancient Israelites, they drank beer, they drank wine. And as the Hippocratic Oath, Hippocrates recommended treating wounds with wine because there are other components within wine, I don't know about beer, that might help to fight infection, but alcohol is one of those significant ingredients.
Right, it is. But some of the same benefits even that we get that has been studied and shown in red wines, the same benefit is studied and shown in grape juice.
I keep asserting grape juice was not widely available. The very rare things you had to do to keep wine from fermenting were not done in Israel. And that's why we see dozens of warnings against drunkenness, and that's why Jesus and everybody refers to wine and fermentation. It's the entire story of the Bible. From the beginning with Noah, the first person who drank wine got plastered. He got drunk. His family was vulnerable because he could no longer be the father he should have been. And so throughout the scriptures, are you familiar with the tithe feast? That's what we call it, from Deuteronomy 14.
Yes.
In that feast, God instructs the Jews, when they have to travel far to go to Jerusalem, ultimately, to bring their sacrifice once a year, God says, you sell your cattle or your grain, whatever you're going to offer to God, you get money for it, and then you take that money and you set aside a part of it, and you use that money to purchase food, wine, and strong drink. This is in Deuteronomy 14, starting in verse 22. And when God says food, wine, and strong drink, the Hebrew word, I don't speak Hebrew, but I could use a lexicon, and the Hebrew word sheker from shekar, which means to get drunk. So that's a cognate noun, strong drink. It's stronger than wine. It's translated typically strong drink. So God says, take the tithe of your grain and your new wine and your oil. And that new wine is because of when they harvest the wine. So take your most recent harvest of grape juice. And in Acts 2, some people thought they were getting drunk on new wine. And go to Jerusalem, and you shall spend that money for whatever your heart desires, for meat, for wine, or strong drink, for whatever your heart desires. And so here's God. If it's a sin to make alcoholic wine, if it's a sin to make strong alcohol, then God is certainly not going to encourage selling it and buying it and consuming it as part of the tithe feast. And so to me, this is a common use of the term wine, and even here, strong drink, in the Bible.
Right. You know, very quickly, Acts 2, again, they had drank much is really the idea, not so much of a staggering, slurring, falling down, passing out type of drunk that they're being accused of, much like John chapter 2, they had drunk much. But in Deuteronomy, not only in Deuteronomy, but there are, if I'm not mistaken, 20 to 23 times that word shaker is used in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew Scriptures. You may have another number. I think in translation, strong drink is used maybe 23. I know of 20 times shaker is used. Out of those times, we have Proverbs 31, which it is to give to those who are dying. We have Numbers 28, verse 7, where it is to be poured out as a drink offering. And then we have Deuteronomy 14. Now, there's three passages. Every other passage, it is in reference to condemnation of strong drink. It is in reference to don't do it, don't drink it, don't have it. And so we have three passages really to be considered. We've already discussed the medicinal purposes from Proverbs 31. They're talking about giving it to those who are dying. And then we have a drink offering to be poured out. And Deuteronomy 14, remember, here is an occasion where the tithe offering that they were going to bring, if it was so great and the travel was the distance, they sell it. They turn it into money. But also, not only was there a tithe offering, there was a feast that was to take place also. And so when you get to Jerusalem, you take that tithe money and you buy that which would be sacrificed and that which you would eat. Mm-hmm. But you're jumping and making an assumption that they're going to consume everything in that list, because remember, they still have to offer sacrifice to God.
And so the text says, you shall spend that money for whatever your heart desires, for oxen or sheep, like having rack of lamb, for wine or similar drink, for whatever your heart desires, you shall eat there before the Lord. You shall rejoice, you and your household. So, Chris, I understand that you don't believe that that refers to drinking wine and drinking strong drink.
But I don't believe it has to.
Right.
This is a difficult, there's no doubt, this is a difficult passage. But when you put it, first of all, in light of every other time the word is used, strong drink, it's always in condemnation unless it's Numbers 28, verse 7, where it's a pour out of a drink offering to God, where it's not consumed but poured out, and the medicinal purposes. Otherwise, it's always condemned or in condemnation. And so here you have two things that are being done. You have the tithe offering that is being brought and the sacrifices that are going to be made, and you have the feast that's going to be offered. Nowhere does it specifically say that, and you're making an assumption, that everything in that list is being consumed by the individual and not offered, whether it is being given to the priest, the Levitical priesthood, and the pouring out, the drink offering, or whether it's being consumed.
And I would say because, and thank you for that, but you're saying it's an assumption, but because the Bible says, all within the same sentence, you shall spend that money for whatever your heart desires, not what God has decreed should be a sacrifice, but spend that money for whatever your heart desires, for oxen or sheep, for wine or strong drink, for whatever your heart desires, you shall eat there before the Lord, you shall rejoice, you and your household. I'm not making an assumption that they're eating and drinking those things. The text says that. You are making an interpretation that it can't mean strong drink.
No, I wouldn't make an interpretation that does not mean strong drink.
All right, so you're saying only that
there are some
not,
that do. The New King
they're
James,
not eating
for example,
and drinking this.
The New King James, for example, says similar drink.
Right, which is a soft interpretation because they don't want to put hard drink.
Right. And like I said, there's 20 other references of use of the word, and it's always strong drink. I would say and concede it's, we're talking about strong liquor.
Do you recall if in Leviticus 10, if that's strong drink, the New King James there says intoxicating drink.
Strong drink. Shaker. It's the same Hebrew word.
Right. And there the Lord says to the first chief priest, Aaron, mm-hmm. the high priest,
right.
He says, do not drink wine or intoxicating drink when you go into the tabernacle. So that would be like saying, God saying, when you go into the tabernacle, don't commit adultery. God wouldn't say that because, again, earlier when I said the dozens of warnings against drunkenness, this is routine. And you did quote a great verse from Ecclesiastes, I think it was.
Yeah, 7:17.
A great verse, much wickedness, but God makes it routine, his warnings against drunkenness, his warning to be ye sober. And so here, this would be so unnatural if it were any sin like murder or adultery or kidnapping or rape. When you go into the tabernacle, don't rape a woman. That would not work. So this is an indication that God is regulating. He's explaining how this is acceptable and how it's unacceptable. And because the priest's service in the tabernacle is a symbol of Jesus Christ, God says, don't cut your hair. Don't do this. Don't do that. Only wear a pure covering of clothing. Don't drink the wine or the grape juice, because they're all symbols of Christ as our covering and his blood. And so on.
Well, it's you've got to be careful. We can read passages on surface, very shallow arguments can be made. And Leviticus 10, you've got to be careful with this. And actually, you made an awesome comparison. I can't remember if it was on a program you did a few weeks back or on the article, where you compared this to Uzzah and not touching the ark. I can't remember if that was in written or...
That was in written.
Okay. And I think you're right on that. I think that is a great comparison to make. In Leviticus 10, notice what is under consideration. First of all, the judgment. That's where we need to focus on. Notice the judgment if they drink wine or strong drink, the shikar, in his presence. They will die. Well, remember Uzzah, if he touches the ark,
right,
he's going to die.
Right.
But was it okay for Uzzah or in his family? Because remember, it was in his father's house. The Ark of the Covenant was in his father's house. David wanted to move it back. When they put that on the ox cart with David's blessing, was that all right? No. You know what? That was still wrong. But the judgment was not death. The judgment of death is if you touch it. But if you ran those poles through the rings...
Right, then you would live.
Then you could... Right.
Chris, we're about out of time. I'd like to quote one last Bible passage and give you the opportunity to close our discussion. The Apostle Paul warns of legalism in Colossians chapter 2. And he says that men subject themselves to regulations like do not touch, do not taste, do not handle. Like do not taste... And I think that applies to wine. According to the commandments and doctrines of men, these things have an appearance of wisdom in self-imposed religion, false humility, and neglect of the body, but they are of no value against the indulgence of the flesh. That's one reason I take up this topic, because I think it distracts from true holiness.
Well, first of all, legalism is not something so much that is condemned, and that's not what we're talking about. Legalism is following the law. When you start to make your own rules, you've gone beyond legalism.
Yeah, I'd say those are two forms of legalism. But go ahead, I'm not going to interrupt you again.
Okay, but Colossians chapter 2, first of all, is in context of the old law. The old law, according to Colossians 2, verses 14, going through verse 17, 18, has been nailed to the cross. That record of debt has been canceled. It has been nailed to the cross. And he says, let no one judge you concerning your festivals, your new moons, and your Sabbaths. There's the yearly observances, monthly observances, and weekly observances. And then he goes on through to the passage that you quoted, talking about what was unclean meats and clean meats, talking about that which is condemned under the old law, not like the Pharisees.
And Chris, we're about out of time, maybe 10 seconds more. Go ahead,
could. Yeah, the Pharisee and the publican. I fast twice a week, self-imposed, the Sermon on the Mount, making their phylacteries broad. That's what's being condemned in Colossians 2.
Chris Peltz, thank you. Your program airs on AM 670 KLTT in Denver an hour before this show does. Bob and Your Life, thank you. It's a pleasure to meet your friend Jeff Cox of Holly Street Church of Christ. God bless you guys.